Nevertheless, I rose with the expressed intention of getting a glass of water for her. Suddenly she said, quite harshly and to my amazement, because of her excellent courtesy, sit down, I don't want water. So somewhat distressed in mind that unwittingly I might have offended, I sat down. I looked across the garden where in the light of the moon several couples promenaded down the paths between the low hedges. I could hear the sound of her breathing beside me. It was disturbed and irregular. All at once she said, "How old are you, Mr. Maston?" I said, 22. Then she said, "I am 29. I stammered something in my surprise. She laughed as though at my confusion and said, "Yes, I am 7 years older than you, Mr. Maston. Does that surprise you, Mr. Maston?" I replied in the affirmative. Then she said, 7 years is a long time. 7 years ago you were a child, Mr. Maston." Then she laughed with a sudden sharpness, but quickly stopped herself to add, "But I wasn't a child. Not 7 years ago, Mr. Maston." I didn't answer her, for there was no thought clear in my head. I sat there in confusion, but in the middle of my confusion I was trying to see what she would have looked like as a child. I could call up no image. Then her husband returned from the house. A few days later, Cass went back to Mississippi to devote some months to his plantation, and under the guidance of Gilbert, to go once to Jackson, the capital, and once to Vicksburg. It was a busy summer. Now Cass could see clearly what Gilbert intended, to make him rich and to put him into politics. It was a flattering and glittering prospect, and one not beyond reasonable expectation for a young man whose brother was Gilbert Maston. "My brother is a man of great taciturnity and strong mind, and when he speaks, though he practices no graces and ingratiations, all men, especially those of the sober sort who have responsibility and power, weigh his words with respect." So the summer passed, under the strong hand and cold eye of Gilbert. But toward the end of the season, when already Cass was beginning to give thought to his return to Transylvania, an envelope came addressed to him from Lexington in an unfamiliar script. When Cass unfolded the single sheet of paper, a small pressed blossom, or what he discovered to be such, slipped out. For a moment he could not think what it was or why it was in his hand. Then he put it to his nostrils. The odor, now faint and dusty, was the odor of jasmine. The sheet of paper had been folded twice to make four equal sections. In one section, in a clean, strong, not large script, he read, "Oh, Cass." That was all. It was enough. One drizzly autumn afternoon, just after his return to Lexington, Cass called at the Trice house to pay his respects. Duncan Trice was not there, having sent word that he had been urgently detained in the town and would be home for a late dinner. Of that afternoon, Cass wrote, "I found myself in the room alone with her. There were shadows, as there had been that afternoon almost a year before, when I first saw her in that room, and when I had thought that her eyes were black. She greeted me civilly, and I replied and stepped back after having shaken her hand. Then I realized that she was looking at me fixedly, as I at her. Suddenly her lips parted slightly and gave a short exhalation, like a sigh or suppressed moan. As of one accord, we moved toward each other and embraced. No words passed between us as we stood there. We stood there for a long time, or so it seemed. I held her body close to me in a strong embrace, but we did not exchange a kiss, which upon recollection has since seemed strange. But was it strange? Was it strange that some remnant of shame should forbid us to look each other in the face? I felt and heard my heart racing within my bosom, with a loose feeling as though it were unmoored and were leaping at random in a great cavity within me, but at the same time I scarcely accepted the fact of my situation. I was somehow possessed by incredulity, even as to my identity, as I stood there and my nostrils were filled with the fragrance of her hair. It was not to be believed that I was Cass Maston, who stood thus in the house of a friend and benefactor. There was no remorse or horror at the turpitude of the act, but only the incredulity which I have referred to. One feels incredulity at the first breaking of a habit, but horror at the violation of a principle. Therefore, what virtue and honor I had known in the past had been an accident of habit and not the fruit of will. Or can virtue be the fruit of human will? The thought is pride. As I have said, we stood there for a long time in a strong embrace, but with her face lowered against my chest and my own eyes staring across the room and out a window into the deepening obscurity of the evening. When she finally raised her face, I saw that she had been silently weeping. Why was she weeping? I've asked myself that question. Was it because, even on the verge of committing an irremediable wrong, she could weep at the consequence of an act which she felt powerless to avoid? Was it because the man who held her was much younger than she, and his embrace gave her the reproach of youth and 7 years? Was it because he had come 7 years too late and could not come in innocence? It doesn't matter what the cause. If it was the first, then the tears can only prove that sentiment is no substitute for obligation. If the second, then they only prove that pity of the self is no substitute for wisdom. But she shed the tears, and finally lifted her face to mine with those tears bright in her large eyes. And even now, though those tears were my ruin, I cannot wish them unshed, for they testify to the warmth of her heart and prove that whatever her sin and mine, she did not step to it with a gay foot and with the eyes hard with lust and fleshly cupidity. The tears were my ruin, for when she lifted her face to me, some streak of tenderness was mixed into my feelings, and my heart seemed to flood itself into my bosom to fill that great cavity wherein it had been leaping. She said, "Cass," the first time she had ever addressed me by my Christian name. "Yes," I replied. "Kiss me," she said very simply. "You can do it now." So I kissed her, and thereupon, in the blindness of our mortal blood, and in the appetite of our hearts, we performed the act. There in that very room, with the servants walking with soft feet somewhere in the house, and with the door to the room open, and with her husband expected, and not yet in the room the darkness of evening. But we were secure in our very recklessness, as though the lustful heart could give forth a cloud of darkness in which we were shrouded, even as Venus once shrouded Aeneas in a cloud, so that he passed unspied among men to approach the city of Dido. In such cases as ours, the very recklessness gives security, as the strength of the desire seems to give the sanction of justice and righteousness. Though she had wept and had seemed to perform the act in a sadness and desperation, immediately afterward she spoke cheerfully to me. She stood in the middle of the room, pressing her hair into place, and I stumblingly ventured some remark about our future, a remark very vague, for my being was still confused, but she responded, "Oh, let us not think about it now," as though I had broached a subject of no consequence. She promptly summoned a servant and asked for lights. They were brought, and thereupon I inspected her face to find it fresh and unmarked. When her husband came, she greeted him familiarly and affectionately, and as I witnessed it, my own heart was wrenched, but not, I must confess, with compunction, rather with a violent jealousy. When he spoke to me and took my hand, so great was my disturbance that I was sure that my face could not but betray it. So began the second phase of the story of Cass Mastern. All that year, as before, he was often in the house of Duncan Trice, and as before, he was often with him in field sports, gambling, drinking, and race-going. He learned, he says, to wear his brow unwrinkled, to accept the condition of things. As for Annabel Trice, he says that sometimes looking back, he could scarcely persuade himself that she had shed tears. She was, he says, of a warm nature, reckless and passionate of disposition, hating all mention of the future. She would never let me mention times to come. Agile, resourceful, and cheerful in devising to gratify our appetites, but with a womanly tenderness such as any man might prize at a sanctified hearthside. She must indeed have been agile and resourceful, for to carry on such a liaison undetected in that age and place must have been a problem. There was a kind of summer house at the foot of the Trice garden, which one could enter unobserved from an alley. Some of their meetings occurred there. A half-sister of Annabel Trice, who lived in Lexington, apparently assisted the lovers or winked at their relationship, but it seems only after some pressure by Annabel, for Cass mentions a stormy scene. So some of the meetings were there, but now and then Duncan Trice had to be out of town on business, and on those occasions Cass would be admitted, late at night, to the house, even during a period when Annabel's mother and father were staying there, so he actually lay in the very bed belonging to Duncan Trice. There were, however, other meetings, unplanned and unpredictable moments snatched when they found themselves left alone together. Scarce a corner, cranny, or protected nook or angle of my friend's trusting house did we not at one time or another defile, and that even in the full and shameless light of day, Cass wrote in the journal. And when Jack Burden, the student of history, went to Lexington and went to see the old Trice house, he remembered the sentence. The town had grown up around the house, and the gardens, except for a patch of lawn, were gone. But the house was well maintained. Some people named Miller lived there, and by and large respected the place, and Jack Burden was permitted to inspect the premises. He wandered about the room where the first meeting had taken place, and she had raised her eyes to Cass Mastern above the newly lighted candles, and where, a year later, she had uttered the sigh or suppressed moan and stepped to his arms, and out into the hall, which was finely proportioned and with a graceful stare, and into a small shadowy library, and to a kind of back hall, which was a well-protected nook or angle, and had, as a matter of fact, furniture adequate to the occasion. Jack Burden stood in the main hall, which was cool and dim, with dully glittering floors, and in the silence of the house recalled that period, some 70 years before, of the covert glances, the guarded whispers, the abrupt rustling of silk in the silence. The costume of the period certainly had not been designed to encourage casual vice. The sharp breath, the reckless sighs. Well, all of that had been a long time before, and Annabel Trice and Cass Mastern were long since deader than mackerel, and Mrs. Miller, who came down to give Jack Burden a cup of tea, she was flattered by the historical interest in her house, though she didn't guess the exact nature of the case, certainly was not agile and didn't look resourceful, and probably had used up all her energy in the Ladies' Altar Guild of St. Luke's Episcopal Church and in the D.A.R.
This ends Disc 7. All the King's Men, Disc 8.
The period of the intrigue, the second phase of the story of Cass Mastern, lasted all of one academic year, part of the summer, for Cass was compelled to go back to Mississippi for his plantation affairs and to attend the wedding of his sister Lavinia, who married a well-connected young man named Willis Burden, and well through the next winter, when Cass was back in Lexington. Then, on March 19, 1854, Duncan Trice died, in his library, which was a protected nook or angle of his house, with a lead slug nearly the size of a man's thumb in his chest. It was quite obviously an accident. The widow sat in church upright and immobile. When she once raised her veil to touch at her eyes with a handkerchief, Cass Mastern saw that the cheek was pale as marble but for a single flushed spot like the flush of a fever. But even when the veil was lowered, he detected the fixed, bright eyes glittering within that artificial shadow. Cass Mastern, with 5 other young men of Lexington, cronies and boon companions of the dead man, carried the coffin. The coffin which I carried seemed to have no weight, although my friend had been of large frame and had inclined to stoutness. As we proceeded with it, I marveled at the fact of its lightness, and once the fancy flitted into my mind that he was not in the coffin at all, that it was empty, and that all the affair was a masquerade or mock show carried to ludicrous and blasphemous length for no purpose as in a dream. Or to deceive me, the fancy came. I was the object of the deception, and all the other people were in league and conspiracy against me. But when that thought came, I suddenly felt a sense of great cunning and a wild exhilaration. I'd been too sharp to be caught so. I had penetrated the deception. I had the impulse to hurl the coffin to the ground and see its emptiness burst open and to laugh in triumph. But I did not, and I saw the coffin sink beneath the level of the earth on which we stood and receive the first clods upon it. As soon as the sound of the first clod striking the coffin came to me, I felt a great relief, and then a most overmastering desire. I looked toward her. She was kneeling at the foot of the grave with what thoughts I could not know. Her head was inclined slightly, and the veil was over her face. The bright sun poured over her black-clad figure. I could not take my eyes from the sight. The posture seemed to accentuate the charms of her person and to suggest to my inflamed senses the suppleness of her members. Even the funereal tint of her costume seemed to add to the provocation. The sunshine was hot upon my neck and could be felt through the stuff of my coat upon my shoulders. It was preternaturally bright, so that I was blinded by it, and my eyes were blinded and my senses warm. But all the while I could hear, as from a great distance, the scraping of the blades upon the piled earth and the muffled sound of earth falling into the excavation. That evening Cass went to the summer house in the garden. It was not by appointment, simply on impulse. He waited there a long time, but she finally appeared, dressed in black, which was scarce darker than the night. He did not speak or make any sign as she approached, gliding like a shadow among shadows, but remained standing where he had been, in the deepest obscurity of the summer house. Even when she entered, he did not betray his presence. I cannot be certain that any premeditation was in my silence. It was prompted by an overpowering impulse which gripped me and sealed my throat and froze my limbs. Before that moment, and afterwards, I knew that it is dishonorable to spy upon another, but at the moment no such considerations presented themselves. I had to keep my eyes fixed upon her as she stood there thinking herself alone in the darkness of the structure. I had the fancy that since she thought herself alone, I might penetrate into her being, that I might learn what change, what effect had been wrought by the death of her husband. The passion which had seized me to the very extent of paroxysm that afternoon at the brink of my friend's grave was gone. I was perfectly cold now, but I had to know, to try to know. It was as though I might know myself by knowing her. It's a human defect, to try to know oneself by the self of another. One can only know oneself in God and in His great eye. She entered the summer house and sank upon one of the benches, not more than a few feet from my own location. For a long time I stood there, peering at her. She sat perfectly upright and rigid. At last I whispered her name, as low as might be. If she heard it, she gave no sign. So I repeated her name in the same fashion, and again. Upon the third utterance, she whispered, "Yes." But she did not change her posture or turn her head. Then I spoke more loudly, again uttering her name, and instantly, with a motion of wild alarm, she rose, with a strangled cry and her hands lifted toward her face. She reeled, and it seemed that she would collapse to the floor, but she gained control of herself and stood there staring at me. Stammeringly, I made my apology, saying that I had not wanted to startle her, that I had understood her to answer yes to my whisper before I spoke, and I asked her, "Did you not answer to my whisper?" She replied that she had. "Then why were you distressed when I spoke again?" I asked her. "Because I did not know that you were here," she said. "But," I said, "you say that you had just heard my whisper and had answered to it, and now you say that you did not know I was here." "I did not know that you were here," she repeated in a low voice, and the import of what she was saying dawned upon me. "Listen," I said. "When you heard the whisper, did you recognize it as my voice?" She stared at me, not answering. "Answer me," I demanded, for I had to know. She continued to stare and finally replied, hesitantly, "I do not know." "You thought it was—" I began, but before I could utter the word, she had flung herself upon me, clasping me in desperation like a person frantic with drowning, and ejaculating, "No, no, it does not matter what I thought. You're here. You are here." And she drew my face down and pressed her lips against mine to stop my words. Her lips were cold, but they hung upon mine. I, too, was perfectly cold as of a mortal chill, and the coldness was the final horror of the act which we performed, as though two dolls should parody the shame and filth of man to make it doubly shameful. After, she said to me, "Had I not found you here tonight, it could never have been between us again." "Why?" I demanded. "It was a sign," she said. "A sign?" I demanded. "A sign that we cannot escape, that we—" And she interrupted herself to resume, whispering fiercely in the dark, "I don't want to escape. It's a sign. Whatever I've done is done." She grew quiet for a moment, then she said, "Give me your hand." I gave her my right hand. She grasped it, dropped it, and said, the other hand." I held it out across my own body, for I was sitting on her left. She seized it with her own left hand, bringing her hand upward from below to press my hand flat against her bosom. Then, fumbling, she slipped a ring upon my finger, the finger next to the smallest. "What is that?" I asked. "A ring," she answered, paused, and added, "It is his ring." Then I recalled that he, my friend, had always worn a wedding ring, and I felt the metal cold upon my flesh. "Did you take it off his finger?" I asked, and the thought shook me. "No," she said. "No," I questioned. "No," she said, "he took it off. It was the only time he ever took it off." I sat beside her, waiting for what I did not know, while she held my hand pressed against her bosom. I could feel it rise and fall. I could say nothing. Then she said, "Do you want to know how? How he took it off?" "Yes," I said in the dark, and waiting for her to speak, I moved my tongue out upon my dry lips. "Listen," she commanded me in an imperious whisper. "That evening after it happened, after the house was quiet again, I sat in my room, in the little chair by the dressing table, where I always sit for Phoebe to let down my hair. I'd sat there out of habit, I suppose, for I was numb all over. I watched Phoebe preparing the bed for the night." Phoebe was her waiting maid, a comely yellow wench somewhat given to the fits and sulks. "I saw Phoebe remove the bolster, and then looked down at a spot where the bolster had lain on my side of the bed. She picked something up and came toward me. She stared at me, and her eyes, they're yellow. You look into them and you can't see what's in them. She stared at me a long time, and then she held out her hand, clenched shut, and she watched me, and then, slow, so slow, she opened up the fingers. And there lay the ring on the palm of her hand. And I knew it was his ring, but all I thought was, 'It's gold, and it's lying in a gold hand.' For Phoebe's hand was gold. I'd never noticed how her hand is the color of pure gold. Then I looked up, and she was still staring at me. And her eyes were gold, too, and bright and hard like gold. And I knew that she knew."
"Knew?"
I echoed, like a question. But I knew, too, now. My friend had learned the truth, from the coldness of his wife, from the gossip of servants, and had drawn the gold ring from his finger and carried it to the bed where he had lain with her and had put it beneath her pillow and had gone down and shot himself, but under such circumstances that no one save his wife would ever guess it to be more than an accident. But he had made one fault of calculation. The yellow wench had found the ring.
"She knows,"
she whispered, pressing my hand hard against her bosom, which heaved and palpitated with a new wildness.
"She knows, and she looks at me. She will always look at me."
Then suddenly her voice dropped, and a wailing intonation came into it.
"She will tell. All of them will know. All of them in the house will look at me and know. When they hand me the dish, when they come into the room and their feet don't make any noise."
She rose abruptly, dropping my hand. I remained seated, and she stood there beside me, her back toward me, the whiteness of her face and hands no longer visible, and to my sight the blackness of her costume faded into the shadow, even in such proximity. Suddenly, in a voice which I did not recognize for its hardness, she said in the darkness above me, "I will not abide it. I will not abide it." Then she turned, and with a swooping motion leaned to kiss me upon the mouth. Then she was gone from my side, and I heard her feet running up the gravel of the path. I sat there in the darkness for a time longer, turning the ring upon my finger. After that meeting in the summer house, Cass did not see Annabel Trice for some days. He learned that she had gone to Louisville, where, he recalled, she had close friends. She had, as was natural, taken Phoebe with her. Then he heard that she had returned, and that night, late, went to the summer house in the garden. She was there, sitting in the dark. She greeted him. She seemed, he wrote later, peculiarly cut off, remote and vague in manner, like a somnambulist or a person drugged. He asked about her trip to Louisville, and she replied briefly that she had been down the river to Paducah. He remarked that he had not known that she had friends in Paducah, and she said that she had none there. Then all at once she turned on him, the vagueness changing to violence, and burst out,
"You are prying. You're prying into my affairs, and I will not tolerate it."
Cass stammered out some excuse before she cut in to say,
"But if you must know, I'll tell you. I took her there."
For a moment Cass was genuinely confused. "Her?" he questioned.
"Phoebe," she replied. "I took her to Paducah, and she's gone."
"Gone? Gone where?"
"Down the river," she answered, repeated, "down the river," and laughed abruptly and added, "And she won't look at me any more like that."
"You sold her?"
"Yes, I sold her. In Paducah, to a man who was making up a coffle of Negroes for New Orleans. And nobody knows me in Paducah. Nobody knew I was there. Nobody knows I sold her. For I shall say she ran away into Illinois. But I sold her for $1,300.
"You got a good price," Cass said, "even for a yellow girl as sprightly as Phoebe." And as he reports in the journal, he laughed with some bitterness and rudeness, though he does not say why.
"Yes," she replied, "I got a good price. I made him pay every penny she was worth, and then do you know what I did with the money, do you?"
"No."
"When I came off the boat at Louisville, there was an old man, a nigger, sitting on the landing stage, and he was blind and picking on a guitar and singing Old Dan Tucker. I took the money out of my bag and walked to him and laid it in his old hat."
If you were going to give the money away, if you felt the money was defiled, why didn't you free her? Cass asked.
"She'd stay right here. She wouldn't go away. She'd stay right here and look at me. Oh, no, she wouldn't go away, for she's the wife of a man the Motleys have, their coachman. Oh, she'd stay right here and look at me and tell what she knows, and I'll not abide it."
Then Cass said, "If you had spoken to me, I would have bought the man from Mr. Motley and set him free, too."
"He wouldn't have sold," she said. "The Motleys won't sell a servant."
"Even to be freed?" Cass continued, but she cut in.
"I tell you, I won't have you interfering with my affairs. Do you understand that?"
And she rose from his side and stood in the middle of the summer house, and he saw the glimmer of her face in the shadow and heard her agitated breathing.
"I thought you were fond of her," Cass said. "I was," she said, until she looked at me like that."
"You know why you got that price for her?" Cass asked, and without waiting for an answer went on,
"Because she's yellow and comely and well-made.
Oh, the drovers wouldn't take her down chained in a coat. They wouldn't wear her down. They'll take her down the river soft. and you know why?"
"Yes, I know why," she said. "And what is it to you? Are you so charmed by her?"
"That is unfair," Cass said.
"Oh, I see, Mr. Maston," she said. "Oh, I see. You are concerned for the honor of a black coachman. It's a very delicate sentiment, Mr. Maston. Why—"
She came to stand above him as he still sat on the bench.
"Why did you not show some such delicate concern for the honor of your friend, who is now dead?"
According to the journal, there was, at this moment, a tempest of feeling in his breast. He wrote, "Thus I heard put into words for the first time the accusation which has ever in all climes been that most calculated to make wince a man of proper nurture or natural rectitude. What the hardened man can bear to hear from the still small voice within may yet be, when spoken by an eternal tongue, an accusation dire enough to drain his very cheeks of blood. But it was not only that accusation in itself, for in very truth I had supped full of that horror and made it my long familiar. It was not merely the betrayal of my friend. It was not merely the death of my friend at whose breast I had leveled the weapon. I could have managed somehow to live with those facts. But I suddenly felt that the world outside of me was shifting, and the substance of things, and that the process had only begun of a general disintegration of which I was the center. At that moment of perturbation, when the cold sweat broke on my brow, I did not frame any sentence distinctly to my mind. But I have looked back and wrestled to know the truth. It was not the fact that a slave woman was being sold away from the house where she had had protection and kindness, and away from the arms of her husband into debauchery. I knew that such things had happened in fact, and I was no child, for after my arrival in Lexington and my acquaintance with the looser sort of companions, the sportsmen and the followers of the races, I had myself enjoyed such diversions. It was not only the fact that the woman for whom I had sacrificed my friend's life and my honor could, in her own suffering, turn on me with a cold rage and the language of insult so that I did not recognize her. It was, instead, the fact that all of these things—the death of my friend, the betrayal of Phoebe, the suffering and rage and great change of the woman I had loved—all had come from my single act of sin and perfidy, as the boughs from the bowl and the leaves from the bough. Or to figure the matter differently, it was as though the vibrations set up in the whole fabric of the world by my act had spread infinitely and with ever-increasing power, and no man could know the end. I did not put it into words in such fashion, but I stood there shaken by a tempest of feeling. When Cass had somewhat controlled his agitation, he said, "To whom did you sell the girl?"
"What's it to you?" she answered. "To whom did you sell the girl?" he repeated. "I'll not tell you," she said.
"I will find out," he said. "I will go to Paducah and find out." She grasped him by the arm, driving her fingers deep into the flesh, like talons, and demanded,
Why are you going?"
"To find her," he said. "To find her and buy her and set her free." He had not premeditated this. He heard the words, he wrote in the journal, and knew that that was his intention. "To find her and buy her and set her free," he said, and felt the grasp on his arm released, and then in the dark suddenly felt the rake of her nails down his cheek, and heard her voice in a kind of wild sibilance saying, if you do, oh, I'll not abide it, I will not." She flung herself from his side and to the bench. He heard her gasp and sob, a hard, dry sob like a man's. He did not move. Then he heard her voice.
If you do, she looked at me that way, and I'll not abide it, if you do.
Then, after a pause, very quietly,
if you do, I shall never see you again.
He made no reply. He stood there for some minutes, he did not know how long, then left the summer house, where she still sat, and walked down the alley. The next morning he left for Paducah. He learned the name of the trader, but he also learned that the trader had sold Phoebe, a yellow wench who answered to Phoebe's description, to a private party who happened to be in Paducah at the time but who had gone on downriver. His name was unknown in Paducah. The trader had presumably sold Phoebe so that he would be free to accompany his coffle when it had been made up. He had now headed, it was said, into South Kentucky with a few bucks and wenches to pick up more. As Cass had predicted, he had not wanted to wear Phoebe down by taking her in the coffle. So getting a good figure of profit in Paducah, he'd sold her there. Cass went south as far as Bowling Green but lost track of his man there. So rather hopelessly, he wrote a letter to the trader in care of the market at New Orleans, asking for the name of the purchaser and any information about him. Then he swung back north to Lexington. At Lexington, he went down to West Short Street, to the Lewis C. Robards Barracoon, which Mr. Robards had converted from the old Lexington Theater a few years earlier. He had a notion that Mr. Robards, the leading trader of the section, might be able, through his downriver connections, to locate Phoebe if enough of a commission was in sight. At the Barracoon there was no one in the office except a boy, who said that Mr. Robards was downriver, but that Mr. Sims was holding things down and was over at the house at an inspection. So Cass went next door to the house. When Jack Burden was in Lexington investigating the life of Cass Mastern, he saw the house, still standing, a two-story brick building of the traditional residential type, roof running lengthwise, door in center of front, window on each side, chimney at each end, lean-to in back. Robards had kept his choice stock there, and not in the coops, to wait for inspection. Cass found the main door unlocked at the house, entered the hall, saw no one, but heard laughter from above. He mounted the stairs and discovered, at the end of the hall, a small group of men gathered at an open door. He recognized a couple of them, young hangers-on he had seen about town and at the track. He approached and asked if Mr. Sims was about. "Inside," one of the men said. "Showing." Over the heads, Cass could see into the room. First he saw a short, strongly made man, a varnished-looking man with black hair, black neckcloth, large bright black eyes, and black coat with a crop in his hand. Cass knew immediately that he was a French speculator who was buying fancies for Louisiana. The Frenchman was staring at something beyond Cass's range of vision. Cass moved farther and could see within. There he saw the man whom he took to be Mr. Sims, a nondescript fellow in a plug hat, and beyond him the figure of a woman. She was a very young woman, some 20 years old, perhaps, rather slender, with skin slightly darker than ivory, probably an octoroon, and hair crisp rather than kinky, and deep, dark, liquid eyes, slightly bloodshot, which stared at a spot above and beyond the Frenchman. She did not wear the ordinary plaid Osnaburg and kerchief of the female slave up for sale, but a white, loosely cut dress, with elbow-length sleeves and skirts to the floor, and no kerchief, only a band to her hair. Beyond her, in the neatly furnished room, quite genteel, the journal called it, while noting the barred windows, Cass saw a rocking chair and little table, and on the table a sewing basket with a piece of fancy needlework lying there with a needle stuck in it, as though some respectable young lady or householder had dropped it casually aside upon rising to greet a guest. Cass recorded that somehow he found himself staring at the needlework. "Yeah," Mr. Sims was saying, "yeah," and grasped the girl by the shoulder to swing her slowly around for a complete view. Then he seized one of her wrists and lifted the arm to shoulder level and worked it back and forth a couple of times to show the supple articulation, saying, "Yeah." That done, he drew the arm forward, holding it toward the Frenchman, the hand hanging limply from the wrist which he held. The hand was, according to the journal, well molded and the fingers tapered. "Yeah," Mr. Sims said, "look at that air hand. Ain't no lady got a little a teensier hand and round and soft, yeah?" "Ain't she got nothing else round and soft?" one of the men at the door called, and the others laughed. "Yeah," Mr. Sims said, and leaned to take the hem of her dress, which with a delicate, flirting motion he lifted higher than her waist, while he reached out with his other hand to wad the cloth and draw it into a kind of awkward girdle about her waist. Still holding the wad of cloth, he walked around her, forcing her to turn. She turned without resistance and as though in a trance, with his motion until her small buttocks were toward the door.
"Round and soft, boys," Mr. Sims said, and gave her a good whack on the near buttock to make the flesh tremble. "Ever get your hand on anything rounder nor softer, boys?" he demanded. "Hitch a cushion, I declare, and shake like sweet jelly."
"Got 'em mighty and got on stockings," one of the men said.
While the other men laughed, the Frenchman stepped to the side of the girl, reached out to lay the tip of his riding crop at the little depression just above the beginning of the swell of the buttocks. He held the tip delicately there for a moment, then flattened the crop across the back and moved it down slowly, evenly, across each buttock to trace the fullness of the curve. "Ten her," he said in his foreign voice. Mr. Sims obediently carried the wad around, and the body followed in the half-revolution. One of the men at the door whistled. The Frenchman laid his crop across the woman's belly as though he were a carpenter measuring something or as to demonstrate its flatness, and moved it down, as before, tracing the structure until it came to rest across the thighs below the triangle. Then he let his hand fall to his side with the crop. "Open your mouth," he said to the girl. She did so, and he peered earnestly at her teeth. Then he leaned and whiffed her breath.
"It is a good breath," he admitted, as though grudgingly.
"Yeah," Mr. Sims said. "Yeah, you ain't a-findin' no better breath."
"Have you any others?" the Frenchman demanded, "on hand?"
"We got 'em," Mr. Sims said.
"Let me see,"
the Frenchman said, and moved toward the door with apparently the insolent expectation that the group there would dissolve before him. He went out into the hall, Mr. Sims following. While Mr. Sims locked the door, Cass said to him, "I wish to speak to you if you are Mr. Sims."
"Huh?"
Mr. Sims said, grunted, according to the journal, but looking at Cass became suddenly civil, for he could know from dress and bearing that Cass was not one of the casual hangers-on. So Mr. Sims admitted the Frenchman to the next room to inspect its occupant and returned to Cass. Cass remarked in the journal that trouble might have been avoided if he had been more careful to speak in private, but he wrote that at the time the matter was so much upon his mind that the men who stood about were as shadows to him. He explained his wish to Mr. Sims, described Phoebe as well as possible, gave the name of the trader in Paducah, and offered a liberal commission. Mr. Sims seemed dubious, promised to do what he could, and then said,
"But 9 out of 10 you won't get 'em, mister. And we got something here better. You done seen Delphi, and she's nigh white as airy woman, and a sight more juicy, and that gal you talk about is nothing but yeller. Now, Delphi—"
"But the young gemman got a hankerin' for yeller,"
one of the hangers-on said, and laughed, and the others laughed too. Cass struck him across the mouth.
"I struck him with the side of my fist," Cass wrote, "to bring blood. I struck him without thought, and I recollect the surprise which visited me when I saw the blood on his chin and saw him draw a bowie from his shirt front. I attempted to avoid his first blow, but received it upon my left shoulder. Before he could withdraw, I had grasped his wrist in my right hand, forced it down so that I could also use my left hand, which still had some strength left at that moment, and with a turning motion of my body, I broke his arm across my right hip and then knocked him to the floor. I recovered the bowie from the floor and with it faced the man who seemed to be the friend of the man who was now prostrate. He had a knife in his hand, but he seemed disinclined to pursue the discussion."
Cass declined the assistance of Mr. Sims, pressed a handkerchief over his wound, walked out of the building and toward his lodgings, and collapsed on West Short Street. He was carried home. The next day he was better. He learned that Mrs. Trice had left the city, presumably for Washington. A couple of days later, his wound infected, and for some time he lay in delirium between life and death. His recovery was slow, presumably retarded by what he termed in the journal his will toward darkness. But his constitution was stronger than his will, and he recovered, to know himself as the chief of sinners and a plague spot on the body of the human world. He would have committed suicide except for the fear of damnation for that act,
for though hopeless of grace, I yet clung to the hope of grace. But sometimes the very fact of damnation because of suicide seemed to be the very reason for suicide. He had brought his friend to suicide, and the friend, by that act, was eternally damned. Therefore he, Cass Mastern, should, in justice, ensure his own damnation by the same act. But the Lord preserve me from self-slaughter for ends which are his and beyond my knowledge.
Mrs. Trice did not come back to Lexington. He returned to Mississippi. For 2 years he operated his plantation, read the Bible, prayed, and, strangely enough, prospered greatly, almost as though against his will. In the end, he repaid Gilbert his debt and set free his slaves. He had some notion of operating the plantation with the same force on a wage basis. "You fool," Gilbert said to him. "Be a private fool if you must, but in God's name don't be a public one. You think you can work 'em and free 'em? One day work, one day loaf. Do you think you can have a passel of free niggers next door to a plantation with slaves? If you did have to set them free, you don't have to spend the rest of your natural life nursing them. Get them out of the country, take up law or medicine, or preach the gospel and at least make a living out of all this praying." Cass tried for more than a year to operate the plantation with his free Negroes, but was compelled to confess that the project was a failure. "Get them out of the country," Gilbert said to him, "and why don't you go with them? Why don't you go north?"
"I belong here," Cass replied.
"Well, why don't you preach abolition right here?" Gilbert demanded. "Do something, do anything, but stop making a fool of yourself trying to raise cotton with free niggers."
"Perhaps I shall preach abolition," Cass said, "someday. Even here, but not now. I'm not worthy to instruct others, not now. But meanwhile, there is my example. If it's good, it's not lost. Nothing is ever lost."
"Except your mind," Gilbert said, and flung heavily from the room. There was a sense of trouble in the air. Only Gilbert's great wealth and prestige and scarcely concealed humorous contempt for Cass saved Cass from ostracism, or worse.
"His contempt for me is a shield," Cass wrote. "He treats me like a wayward and silly child who may learn better and who does not have to be taken seriously. Therefore my neighbors do not take me seriously."
But trouble did come. One of Cass's Negroes had a broad wife on a plantation nearby. After she had had some minor trouble with the overseer, the husband stole her from the plantation and ran away. Toward the Tennessee border, the pair were taken. The man, resisting officers, was shot. The woman was brought back. "You see," Gilbert said, "all you've managed to do is get one nigger killed and one nigger whipped. I offer my congratulations."
So Cass put his free Negroes on a boat bound upriver and never heard of them again. I saw the boat head out into the channel and watched the wheels churn against the strong current, and my spirit was troubled. I knew that the Negroes were passing from one misery to another, and that the hopes they now carried would be blighted. They had kissed my hands and wept for joy, but I could take no part in their rejoicing. I had not flattered myself that I had done anything for them. What I had done for myself, to relieve my spirit of a burden, the burden of their misery and their eyes upon me. The wife of my dead friend had found the eyes of the girl Phoebe upon her and had gone wild and had ceased to be herself and had sold the girl into misery. I had found their eyes upon me and had freed them into misery lest I should do worse. For many cannot bear their eyes upon them and enter into evil and cruel ways in their desperation. There was in Lexington, a decade or more before my stay in that city, a wealthy lawyer named Fielding L. Turner, who had married a lady of position from Boston. This lady, Caroline Turner, who had never had blacks around her and who had been nurtured in sentiments opposed to the institution of human servitude, quickly became notorious for her abominable cruelties performed in her fits of passion. All persons of the community reprehended her floggings, which she performed with her own hands, uttering meanwhile little cries in her throat, according to report. Once, while she was engaged in flogging a servant in an apartment on the second floor of her palatial home, a small Negro boy entered the room and began to whimper. She seized him and bodily hurled him through the window of the apartment so that he fell upon stone below and broke his back to become a cripple for his days. to protect her from the process of law and the wrath of the community. Judge Turner committed her to a lunatic asylum. But later the physician said her to be of sound mind and released her. Her husband in his will left her no slaves, for to do so would, the will said, be to doom them to misery and life and a speedy death. But she procured slaves, among them a yellow coachman named Richard, mild of manner, sensible, and plausible disposition. One day she had him chained and proceeded to flog him, but he tore himself from the chains that held him to the wall and seized the woman by the throat and strangled her. Later he was captured and hanged for murder, though many wished that his escape had been contrived. This story was told to me in Lexington. One lady said to me, "Mrs. Turner did not understand Negroes." And another, "Mrs. Turner did it because she was from Boston, where the abolitionists are." But I did not understand. Then, much later, I began to understand. I understood that Mrs. Turner flogged her Negroes for the same reason that the wife of my friend sold Phoebe down the river. She could not bear their eyes upon her. I understand, for I can no longer bear their eyes upon me. Perhaps only a man like my brother Gilbert can, in the midst of evil, retain enough of innocence and strength to bear their eyes upon him and to do a little justice in the terms of the great injustice. So Cass, who had a plantation with no one to work it, went to Jackson, the capital of the state, and applied himself to the law. Before he left, Gilbert came to him and offered to take over the plantation and work it with a force of his people from his own great place on a share basis. Apparently, he was still trying to make Cass rich, but Cass declined, and Gilbert said, "You object to my working it with slaves, is that it? Well, let me tell you, if you sell it, it will be worked with slaves. It is black land and will be watered with black sweat. Does it make any difference, then, which black sweat falls on it?" And Cass replied that he was not going to sell the plantation. Then Gilbert, in an apoplectic rage, bellowed, "My God, man, it is land. Don't you understand? It is land. And land cries out for man's hand." But Cass did not sell. He installed a caretaker in the house and rented a little land to a neighbor for pasture. He went to Jackson, sat late with his books, and watched trouble gathering over the land. For it was the autumn of 1858 when he went to Jackson. On January 9th, 1861, Mississippi passed the Ordinance of Secession. Gilbert had opposed secession, writing to Cass, "The fools! There's not a factory for arms in the state. Fools not to have prepared themselves if they have foreseen the trouble. Fools, if they have not foreseen it, to act thus in the face of facts. Fools not to temporize now, and if they must, prepare themselves to strike a blow. I've told responsible men to prepare. All fools." To which Cass replied, "I pray much for peace." But later he wrote, "I have talked with Mr. French, who is, as you know, the chief of ordnance, and he says that they have only old muskets for troops, and those but flintlocks. The agents have scraped the state for shotguns at the behest of Governor Pettus. Shotguns," Mr. French said and curled his lips. "And what shotguns," he added, and then told me of a weapon contributed to the cause, an old musket barrel strapped with metal to a piece of cypress rail crooked at one end. An old slave gave his treasure to the cause, and does one laugh or weep? After Jefferson Davis had come back to Mississippi, having resigned from the Senate, and had accepted the command of the troops of Mississippi with the rank of Major General, Cass called upon him at the request of Gilbert. He wrote to Gilbert, "The general says that they have given him 10,000 men, but not a stand of modern rifles. But the general also said, they've given me a very fine coat with 14 brass buttons in front and a black velvet collar. Perhaps we can use the buttons in our shotguns," he said, and smiled. Cass saw Mr. Davis once more, for he was with Gilbert on the steamboat Natchez, which carried the new president of the Confederacy on the first stage of his journey from his plantation, Briarfield, to Montgomery. "We were on old Mr. Tom Leather's boat," Cass wrote in the journal, "which had been supposed to pick up the president at a landing a few miles below Briarfield. But Mr. Davis was delayed in leaving his house and was rowed out to us. I leaned on the rail and saw the little black skiff proceeding toward us over the red water. A man waved from the skiff to us. The captain of the Natchez observed the signal
and gave a great blast of his boat's whistle, which made our ears tingle and shivered out over the expanse of waters. The boat stopped and the skiff approached. Mr. Davis was received on board. As the steamboat moved on, Mr. Davis looked back and lifted his hand in salute to the Negro servant, Isaiah Montgomery, whom I had known at Briarfield, who stood in the skiff, which rocked in the wash of the steamboat, and waved his farewell. Later, as we proceeded upriver toward the bluffs of Vicksburg, he approached my brother, with whom I was standing on the deck. We had previously greeted him. My brother again, and more intimately, congratulated Mr. Davis, who replied that he could take no pleasure in the honor. "I have," he said, "always looked upon the Union with a superstitious reverence, and have freely risked my life for its dear flag on more than one battlefield, and you, gentlemen, can conceive the sentiment now in me that the object of my attachment for many years has been withdrawn from me." And he continued, "I have in the present moment only the melancholy pleasure of an easy conscience." Then he smiled, as he did rarely. Thereupon he took his leave of us and retired within. I had observed how worn to emaciation was his face by illness and care, and how thin the skin lay over the bone. I remarked to my brother that Mr. Davis did not look well. He replied, "A sick man. It's a fine howdy-do to have a sick man for a president." I responded that there might be no war, that Mr. Davis hoped for peace. But my brother said, "Make no mistake. The Yankees will fight, and they will fight well, and Mr. Davis is a fool to hope for peace." I replied, "All good men hope for peace." At this, my brother uttered an indistinguishable exclamation and said, "What we want, now they've got into this, is not a good man, but a man who can win. And I'm not interested in the luxury of Mr. Davis's conscience." Then my brother and I continued our promenade in silence, and I reflected that Mr. Davis was a good man. But the world is full of good men, I now reflect as I write these lines down, and yet the world drives hard into darkness and the blindness of blood, even as now, late at night, I sit in this hotel room in Vicksburg, and I move to ask the meaning of our virtue. May God hear our prayer. Gilbert received a commission as colonel in a cavalry regiment. Cass enlisted as a private in the Mississippi Rifles. "You could be a captain," Gilbert said, "or a major. You got brains enough for that, and," he added, "damn few of them have." Cass replied that he preferred to be a private soldier, marching with other men. But he could not tell his brother why, or tell his brother that, though he would march with other men and would carry a weapon in his hand, he would never take the life of an enemy. "I must march with these men who march," he wrote in the journal, "for they are my people, and I must partake with them of all bitterness, and that more fully. But I cannot take the life of another man. How can I, who have taken the life of my friend, take the life of an enemy, for I have used up my right to blood?" So Cass marched away to war, carrying the musket, which was for him but a meaningless burden, and wearing on a string, against the flesh of his chest, beneath the fabric of the gray jacket, the ring which had once been Duncan Trice's wedding ring, and which Annabel Trice, that night in the summer house, had slipped onto his finger as his hand lay on her bosom. Cass marched to Shiloh, between the fresh fields, for it was early April, and then into the woods that screened the river. Dogwood and Redbud would have been out then. He marched into the woods, heard the lead whistle by his head, saw the dead men on the ground, and the next day came out of the woods and moved in the sullen withdrawal toward Corinth. He'd been sure that he would not survive the battle, but he had survived and moved down the crowded road as in a dream. And he wrote, "And I felt that henceforward I should live in that dream." The dream took him into Tennessee again, Chickamauga, Knoxville, Chattanooga, and the nameless skirmishes, and the bullet for which he waited did not find him. At Chickamauga, when his company wavered in the enemy fire and seemed about to break in its attack, he moved steadily up the slope and could not understand his own inviolability, and the men regrouped and followed. "It seems strange to me," he wrote, "that I, who in God's will sought death and could not find it, should in my seeking lead men to it who did not seek.
When Colonel Hickman congratulated him, he could find no words for answer. But if he had put on the gray jacket in anguish of spirit and in hope of expiation, he came to